Ever feel like you're just drowning in information, you know, trying to wrap your head around something complex, maybe a new field or just something tricky?
Yeah, like staring at a giant puzzle with a million pieces scattered everywhere.
Exactly. Well, you've come to the right place. Welcome to the deep dive. We're here to sift through all that complexity and pull out the core ideas, the stuff you really need to know.
And today, we're talking to you, the learner. We get it, you're curious, you want deep understanding, but, well, time's precious, right?
Absolutely. Think of us as your guides through the maze.
Our mission today is to make sense of statistical mechanics. It's a fascinating area. We're drawing from some great material, specifically Bouvier's statistical mechanics and random systems.
Right. It covers the whole journey from the early days with gases right up to really complex stuff like spin glasses.
And we'll be extracting those key moments, the foundational concepts, making it all accessible, but still, substantial, giving you that solid overview.
Okay, let's dive in. So the source material, it points to the early 20th century Gibbs as being really central to getting statistical mechanics going.
Yeah, but it didn't just pop up fully formed. It actually grew out of earlier work, right? Kinetic theory, Maxwell.
That's it. Maxwell and the kinetic theory of gases. But what's interesting, and the text highlights this, is that this statistical way of thinking wasn't immediately embraced.
No, definitely not. People were skeptical. Using probabilities to describe matter, it seemed a bit out there at the time.
And weirdly, quantum mechanics was bubbling up around the same time, focusing on the super small scale, almost the opposite end of the spectrum.
Right. Though eventually they found common ground in quantum statistical mechanics. But for today, we're sticking mostly to the classical side of things.
Okay, so classical statistical mechanics, what's the main goal? Why look at things statistically instead of tracking every single particle?
Well, the big idea, and our source really emphasizes this, is bridging the gap, connecting the microscopic world of particles to the macroscopic things we actually observe, like temperature, pressure, thermodynamics, essentially.
Right, explaining the big picture from the small details.
Exactly. The text uses a neat example, an ideal gas, but just in one dimension, with like a movable wall. By thinking about the average behavior of tons of these little non-interacting particles bouncing around, you can see how something like pressure just emerges from all that microscopic chaos.
So it comes from the collective action.
Yes, precisely. And a key assumption there is that all the possible ways the particles could be arranged, given the overall energy and stuff, are equally likely. And entropy. Entropy is crucial for figuring out which macroscopic states are more probable.
Okay, probability is key then. And the text introduces this term, the microcanonical ensemble. What's that about?
Right, the microcanonical ensemble. Think of it not as one single snapshot of the system, but like a giant collection of all possible snapshots.
All the ways it could look.
Exactly. All the possible microscopic states the system could be in if you keep the total energy, the volume, and the number of particles fixed.
Like looking at all possible poker hands to figure out your odds.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. The idea is that over time, the system's actual behavior will match the average calculated over this whole ensemble of possibilities.
And you mentioned entropy being important here. How does it connect?
It's deeply connected. In this microcanonical picture, the entropy is basically a measure of how many microscopic arrangements correspond to a given macroscopic state. It's tied directly to the probability distribution.
So more arrangements means higher entropy, more probable.
It tells you the likelihood of seeing a certain state, especially if you allow other things like the volume in that gas example to change.
Got it. Now, the source also mentions the canonical ensemble and the Gibbs measure, different scenario.
Yeah, slightly different setup. The canonical ensemble is what you use when your system isn't isolated, but it's sitting in like a big heat bath. Think of a beaker of water in a room.
So it can exchange energy with its surroundings.
Exactly. The energy of the system itself can fluctuate up and down, but the overall temperature stays constant because the bath is so large. The Gibbs measure is the probability distribution you use in this situation.
And there's something called the partition function that sounds important.
Oh, it's central. The partition function is, well, it's this big mathematical sum. It takes every single possible microscopic state, figures out its energy, and weights it according to the temperature.
Kind of like a master accounting tool.
That's a great way to put it. Once you can calculate the partition function, and that can be pretty challenging sometimes, you can derive basically all the important thermodynamic properties from it. Free energy, entropy, pressure, you name it.
Okay, so far we've mostly talked about particles that don't interact, like ideal gases. But reality is messier, right? Particles bump into each other, attract each other.
Definitely. And that's where things get really interesting. The text brings up the van der Waals model as an early attempt to deal with these interactions.
Van der Waals. What did that model add?
It tried to capture two really basic things about real particles. One, they take up space they can't overlap, like a hard core.
Basic repulsion.
Right. And two, they tend to attract each other slightly when they're nearby. So it adds just these two simple ideas. Particles have size, and they have short-range attraction.
And did it work?
Remarkably well, actually. Much better than the ideal gas law for describing real gases, especially near condensation. It showed how even simple interactions fundamentally change the behavior.
The text mentions something about a Maxwell correction and the convex hull of the free energy. That sounds technical.
It is a bit, but the core idea isn't too bad.
How about?
Imagine plotting the system's free energy against its volume. The raw van der Waals model sometimes predicts energy values in certain regions that aren't actually stable, like little dips where the system wouldn't want to stay.
Unphysical states.
Sort of. Maxwell's fix was basically to draw a straight line that's the convex hull part across those unstable dips. That straight line represents the mixture of phases, like liquid and gas coexisting, that the system actually adopts during a phase transition. It smooths out the weird bits.
Okay, that makes sense. Smoothing out the unrealistic predictions.
Exactly. And it also touches on the idea of the thermodynamic limit. What happens when the system gets really, really big? And under what conditions our whole thermodynamic picture still holds up?
Right. So after van der Waals, the text shifts focus to lattice gases and spin systems, particularly the Ising model. Why the shift?
Well, the Ising model was a huge step forward. It's a bit more abstract, maybe, but incredibly powerful. Think of a grid, a lattice.
Like a checkerboard.
Yeah, sort of. And at each spot on the grid, you have a spin. It can point either up or down. Just two states.
Okay, simple units.
Very simple. And these spins interact with their neighbors. Maybe they prefer to align, maybe they prefer to be opposite. And you can also have an external magnetic field trying to push them all one way.
So like tiny magnets on a grid.
That's the intuition. And it turns out this simple setup is mathematically the same as a lattice gas, where sites are either occupied by a particle or empty. The goal is to understand the collective behavior. Do they all line up? Do they stay random? Can you get magnetism?
And does the partition function idea still work here?
Absolutely.
Right.
You calculate a canonical partition function for the Ising model, summing over every possible way you could arrange all the ups and downs on the whole lattice.
That sounds like a lot of possibilities.
It's astronomical.
Yeah.
But each arrangement, each configuration is weighted by its energy based on the neighbor interactions and the external field, and of course, the temperature.
And from that, you get the free energy again.
Yep. The Helmholtz free energy comes from the logarithm of that partition function. Tells you about the equilibrium state. And often, to make the math manageable, especially for like computer simulations or theoretical calculations, people use periodic boundary conditions. Imagine wrapping the grid around. The right edge connects to the left edge, the top connects to the bottom, turns a square into a donut shape, a torus. It avoids edge effects, simplifies things.
Clever. Okay, so we have these microscopic spins. How do we get back to things we can actually measure? The macroscopic properties. The text mentioned magnetization.
Right. Magnetization is key. It's just the average alignment. Are more spins pointing up or down? You calculate it for any given arrangement of spins just by averaging plus one for up, negative one for down.
So high magnetization means most spins agree.
Exactly. And zero magnetization means it's all balanced out or random. There's also the empirical spin distribution, just counting the fraction of up versus down spins.
And how do we predict the likely magnetization?
Well, in simply models like the Curie-Weiss model, which is a type of mean field model.
Mean field, what does that mean?
Ah, good question. Mean field basically ignores the spatial structure, the lattice. It assumes every spin interacts equally with every other spin in the whole system, no matter how far apart they are.
That sounds like a major simplification.
It is, a huge one. But it makes the math much easier and can still capture some essential physics, especially the idea of phase transitions.
Like magnets forming.
Exactly. In the Curie-Weiss model, you can see how below a certain critical temperature, the system can suddenly develop a non-zero magnetization, even if you don't apply an external field. Spontaneous magnetization.
How does the model show that?
It comes down to the shape of the free energy again. It can become non-convex, meaning it develops multiple minima. And there are powerful math tools called large deviation principles that help quantify the probability of seeing different magnetization values. They show that for these long-range interaction models, certain macroscopic states become overwhelmingly likely as the system grows.
Okay, so mean field gives us a flavor of phase transitions, but we've mostly talked about finite systems or simplified ones. The text then talks about defining Gibbs measures directly in infinite volume. Why go infinite?
That's a really important conceptual leap. Thinking about infinitely large systems lets us describe phenomena that are hard or even impossible to capture just by looking at finite systems and trying to scale up.
Like what?
A key example is phase coexistence. Imagine a magnet cooled below its critical temperature. Even if you turn off the external field, you might still have large regions pointing up, coexisting stably, with regions pointing down. This kind of persistent macroscopic order across vast distances is described much more naturally in an infinite volume setting.
But how do you know if this infinite system description makes sense, if it gives a unique answer? The text mentions Debrecen-Kotecki price and Pyles.
Right. Those are mathematical tools to figure out if this system has just one stable equilibrium state, a unique Gibbs measure, or if it can exist in multiple distinct stable states, multiple Gibbs measures. Multiple states signal a phase transition.
So one tells you it's unique, the other that it's not.
Kind of. The Debrecen-Kotecki price, DKP criterion, gives you conditions, based on how strong the interactions are, that guarantee uniqueness. If the interactions are weak enough or short range enough, you only get one phase.
And Pyles.
The Pyles argument is often a more direct way to prove non-uniqueness, to show there are multiple stable states. It usually involves looking at the energy cost of creating a boundary between two different potential phases, like a domain wall between upspins and downspins.
If the boundary doesn't cost too much energy, the phases can coexist.
That's the essence of it, yes. If the cost is finite in the infinite limit, it suggests multiple phases are possible.
The text also quickly mentions FKG inequalities and monotonicity. Where do they fit in?
Ah, yes. FKG inequalities are really useful math tools, especially for models like ferromagnets, where interactions tend to make things align. They tell you that certain events are positively correlated, like if one spin is up, it makes it more likely its neighbor is also up. Monotonicity just means that certain properties change predictably, like magnetization increasing if you increase the external field.
And these help prove phase transitions, too.
They're often used alongside arguments like Pyrrhus to make the proofs rigorous. They help control the correlations in the system. And as the source notes for the standard Ising model, it gets complicated. In 1D and 2D, you generally have a unique state above zero temperature. But in 3D and higher dimensions, at low enough temperatures, you do get multiple Gibbs states. You get that spontaneous magnetization.
Okay, so that's ordered systems. But then the deep dive shifts to disordered systems and spin glasses. Sounds messy.
It is. Disordered systems are where the interactions themselves, or maybe external fields, are random, not uniform across the system.
So instead of every neighbor interaction being the same, it varies randomly.
Exactly. Imagine a magnetic alloy where the connections between atoms are just randomly strong or weak, or even favoring anti-alignment randomly. This randomness adds a whole new layer of profound complexity.
How do you even describe these?
We start talking about random Gibbs measures, and sometimes even metastates, which are like probability distributions over probability distributions, to handle the randomness in the interactions. Proving uniqueness of equilibrium states here is way harder.
But phase transitions are still interesting.
Oh, absolutely. They are a central focus. How does this system behave collectively despite or because of this built-in randomness?
The text mentions the random field Ising model, so random magnetic fields now.
Yeah, building on the standard Ising model, but now each site feels a random local magnetic field, pushing it up or down randomly on top of the usual neighbor interactions trying to align them.
Does the alignment survive the random fields?
That's the core question. There's a famous argument, the Imre-Mahl argument, just based on energy versus entropy, suggesting that in low dimensions, like 2D, any tiny amount of random field should be enough to destroy the long-range ferromagnetic order. The spins can lower their energy by flipping in response to the local random field more effectively than they gain from aligning globally.
And was that proven? The text mentions Eisenmenwehr.
Yes. The Eisenmenwehr method provided a rigorous mathematical proof, confirming that intuition, at least in 2D. It showed there's no spontaneous magnetization in the 2D random field Ising model. Higher dimensions are more complicated.
Okay, random fields are one thing. What about spin glasses? where the interactions themselves are random. The text mentions turning back to mean field models, like REM and SK. Why mean field again?
Because the full lattice problem with random interactions is incredibly difficult. Mean field models, by ditching the detailed spatial structure and assuming all-to-all interactions, become mathematically, well, maybe not easy, but more tractable. They let us explore the consequences of the randomness itself.
So what's the random energy model, the REM?
REM is sort of the ultimate simplification for disordered energy landscapes. You imagine all the possible spin configurations, all the ways of assigning plus one or Nyquan to n spins, and then you just assign a completely random energy value, drawn from some distribution like a Gaussian, to each of those 2n configurations, independently.
Wow, okay. No structure to the energy at all, just random numbers.
Pretty much. It's surprisingly useful. You can actually calculate things like the average free energy over the randomness. And it exhibits concepts like self-averaging, the idea that for a very large system, the properties of one specific realization of the randomness become identical to the average over all possible random realizations.
And the SK model, Sherrington Kirkpatrick.
The SK model is a step more sophisticated than RM, but still mean field. It has pairwise interactions between all spins, but the strength of each interaction, Gi, between spin I and spin J, is chosen randomly, usually from Gaussian distribution.
So interactions are random, but still pair-based.
Right, and it depends on the overlap between spin configurations, too. It's famous for having an incredibly complex low-temperature phase. Physicists, particularly Parisi, developed a groundbreaking, though initially non-rigorous, mathematical structure involving replica symmetry breaking to solve it.
Replicas? That sounds complex.
It is. It involves imagining multiple copies or replicas of the system. Later work, especially by Guerra, provided more rigorous bounds and insights, connecting the structure of the SK states to hierarchical tree-like structures seen in related models like the CREM, continuous random energy model.
Hierarchical structures again. And the text mentions Gerlande-Guerra relations.
Yes, the Gerlande-Guerra identities. They're a set of exact mathematical relations that must be satisfied by the overlaps between different states sampled from the Gibbs measure in the SK model. They provide really strong constraints on what the equilibrium state can look like.
But it's still not fully understood.
The precise structure, especially this property called ultramatricity, a very specific hierarchical way the states are organized, is still an area of intense research. It's mathematically very deep.
Okay, switching gears slightly, the deep dive then brings up the Hopfield model. This one sounds different, inspired by neural networks.
Exactly. The Hopfield model is another mean field model, but its motivation comes directly from neuroscience and the idea of associative memory.
Like how our brains recall things.
Kinda, yeah. The model tries to capture how a network of neuron-like units, represented by spins here, can store specific patterns of activity and then recall a whole pattern, even if you give it just a noisy or incomplete part of it.
How does it store patterns?
You essentially design the interactions between the spins, the G terms, based on the patterns you want to store. The interactions are set up so that the stored patterns become low energy states, stable configurations of the system's Hamiltonian.
So the system naturally falls into these memory states.
That's the idea. Analysis then focuses on things like, how many patterns can you store reliably before the system gets confused? This often involves using statistical mechanics tools, again, like large deviations. There's also the idea of a replica symmetric solution, which works okay when you only store a few patterns, but breaks down when you try to store too many.
Interesting. And the text even links this to number partitioning. That seems like a jump.
It is surprising, isn't it? But yeah, the computational problem of number partitioning, taking a list of numbers and trying to split it into two groups with sums as equal as possible, can actually be mapped onto a spin glass type of problem.
How?
You can represent assigning a number to one group or the other using a spin, plus one or Nyquan. The energy function can be designed so that minimizing the energy corresponds to minimizing the difference between the two subset sums.
So finding the best partition is like finding the ground state of the spin system.
Exactly. And analyzing the spin system using tools from statistical mechanics, like relating it to their REM or using large deviation theory, helps explain why number partitioning is computationally hard. NP hard, in fact. It reveals the complex energy landscape associated with the problem.
Wow. The same math applies to magnets and this abstract number problem.
It shows the power of the framework.
Okay, the learner. Let's try and wrap this up. We've covered a lot of ground here. From the very beginnings of statistical mechanics trying to explain gases.
Through understanding interactions with models like Van der Waals, Then the crucial Ising model for phase transitions.
Then diving into the really complex world of disordered systems, random fields, spin glasses like REM and SK.
And even seeing connections pop up in neural network models like Hopfield and computational problems like number partitioning.
So what's the big takeaway here?
For me, it's the incredible unifying power of this statistical viewpoint. You have systems with countless interacting parts, maybe with randomness thrown in, and yet by focusing on probabilities, average behaviors, and emergent properties, we can build a coherent understanding.
It's a way to handle complexity.
It's a very powerful way, and it applies far beyond just physics. The principles are surprisingly universal.
Any aha moments that stood out for you from our source material?
I think just seeing the journey itself, how the field built upon itself, from simple ideal gases to these incredibly intricate spin glass models. And maybe that connection between the SK model's complexity and things like the Hopfield model or even number partitioning, it really drives home how these abstract physics models can capture features of complexity in, well, completely different domains.
Absolutely. So for you, the learner, if something here really grabbed you, where could you look next?
Oh, lots of directions. If phase transitions were cool, look into critical phenomena, maybe the renormalization group, that's a whole fascinating story.
And if the disorder was intriguing?
Then definitely dive deeper into spin glasses.
Yeah.
Parisi solution, ultrametricity, ongoing research there is cutting edge.
Or the random field models.
What about a Hopfield model connection?
Yeah, that opens up the whole field of statistical mechanics applied to neural networks, machine learning, information processing. Huge area now. Right. Okay, so a final thought to leave you with, the learner. We've seen how statistical reasoning helps us understand systems with tons of interacting parts, often with randomness involved. Think about how much of the world works like that, from biology to economics to social networks.
It's everywhere.
So the question is, just how far can this statistical way of thinking take us? Could it be the fundamental language for understanding complexity itself wherever we find it? Something to ponder.
Definitely something to think about.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.